Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts were culled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was titled, I Am a Camera, Exploring the Nuance of Point of View. When starting to write, deciding which type of point of view will be exploited is a significant decision with far-reaching consequences. Who knows what? Who sees what? How much do you want the reader to know? And when? Once the decisions are made, they can be both liberating and confining. Yours truly explored these issues, the slings and arrows of points of view, with Robin Cadwallader, Julian Leatherdale, and Belinda Castle. One of the first major decisions when you're starting a new manuscript is which character or which characters are going to tell your story. The prudent choice of point of view is quintessential to the novel, and I'd wager it's quintessential to the readers and moreover the writer's well-being. Expert use of point of view provides a device where you can take the reader by the hand and lead them through the story, yet allow the author to remain in control, revealing and occluding information as they need for the story's telling to be seamless. The choice of point of view often has to be made when other aspects of the evolving novel still haven't fully precipitated. For me, it's always the first splash of colour on the blank canvas. But a wrong choice can damage the novel, and it takes you a lot of time. It's very expensive to go back and fix it up or change it. The three writers here today have used point of view in quite distinct ways. So I hope the discussion that we can create today will be feverish and percussive, if that's possible. But firstly, has anyone got any gossip or anything they'd like to share? Someone in the industry?
Maybe it will emerge as we go on.
We'll get your point of view on that then. So, first I'd just like to ask you, all three of you, what you understand by this crazy little thing called point of view. To start the ball rolling, I'd say it allows the author efficient, strategic omitting of the truth.
I see that as a very downstream effect. And it's true, you know, in my first novel I had a cast of 8 over 100 years, so it was very useful to be able to use point of view for points in and out of different time periods. But for me, and I don't think this is at all controversial, point of view is about character. Who has the right to tell the story? It may be more than one person. It may be a contested point of view. But I think the only way to work through a story and reveal the story world is to give primary concern to the character, the main character or characters. They are the sort of headlights in the darkness. So I see it as absolutely fundamental, and yes, devastating if you get off on the wrong foot. Thankfully, touch something like wood. Hasn't happened to me yet, but Margaret Atwood helpfully says in her online classes, just write and then go back and do it again. Good on you, Margaret, that's great advice. I'm glad you can do that.
Yeah, time.
But I think, you know, when you think about point of view for a character, you've already made some very major decisions about the story and the structure of the story. Mm. They're kind of unwrapped for you almost straight away.
So you're talking about choice of which character carries the story.
Yes, which character carries the story, and also we'll talk about first and third, probably more than second, which is going to work better for you.
Yeah.
So Robin,
Well, I'm very visual when I'm writing, so for me it's very much sort of the eyes, the reader's eyes, what they will see in the story. So The choice of character is different again, but the point of view that the character has, if it's first person or third person, that will give the reader the sight and the knowledge of the story. In terms of choice of character, I think they're the people in the story that interest me the most. That I don't think I'm. We were just talking about whether we're strategic. I don't think I'm particularly strategic. I'm a bit more instinctive, and then afterwards I find out whether that was a good instinct or a bad one. And then once I'm at a certain point, I recognise strategy, I think. But in my last novel, it was really very much, I had three characters who just felt they needed a voice. So that's how I chose them.
Well, it's a question that I've got wrong many times and had to redo it. But I actually don't know that it's as disastrous as it sounds, because it's a kind of way of getting to what is important in the story. Because I think that point of view, like the sort of the question that underlines it is where is the voice coming from and what does it know? And if you choose wrongly, it might be because you don't know where it would be best for those things to come from yet, because you haven't quite written your way to what your story is really about. So I have done that wrong, and been reasonably sort of game about just doing it again, and kind of that's part of the tinkering. And I would say I was really glad to be invited onto this panel to talk about this book, because I got it wrong, and because when I felt I'd solved it, I felt I'd solved the book.
Right. Well, just to summarise first, I thought I'd just go through the major types of point of view. One academic I was reading suggested that there were 26 different types, which seemed exhaustive and about as useful as a Bristol stool chart, really. I think there's kind of three major points of view. The first person point of view, which is the I narrator. The second person point of view, which is you, which is quite unusual and rare, and I find it quite distracting. Then there's two types of third person point of view. You've got a close or limited point of view, which means that you're in a character or a couple of characters' heads. Or there's the grand omniscient narrator, which is, again, I think rare and often not very well done, and can lead to head hopping, which we'll have a chat about later. So I'd like each of you again to just maybe give us a bit of a description of your novels, kind of flesh them out as far as you'd like to go without giving them away, and just give us a bit of a description of how you deployed point of view and what efforts you made to delineate the points of view within the text. So, Belinda first.
Okay, all right. So there are different points of view for different sections. So Hannah and Emil tells the story of Hannah and Emil. And there's another character who is their granddaughter, who is really a stand-in for me because it's a book about my grandparents. So there's a brief section at the beginning in the third person about Flora Belinda. And then there's sort of alternating Hannah and Emil sections. Hannah's is from the first person. And Emil's is from the third person. And the reason that I sort of landed on those in the end was there were a few things going on. So the Hannah first person voice is really a voice that was in the papers that I inherited, in her letters and in her. She wrote a kind of piecemeal memoir that we found after she died. And because I knew her well when I was a child, that I voice was just, I never really was in any doubt about. I could hear her and she wanted to speak as I. And then so I guess that made me a third person, the Flora person, because I couldn't compete with that. and then the Emil, that this was what I had trouble with. The Emil third person was a sort of a close third person, free and direct style, where it sort of inflected with the way that they might speak or think. The reason that that was third person in the end was because I wanted to suggest that somebody was imagining his story. It was kind of a slightly distancing kind of gesture of decorum, that this is speculative, because I knew him much less well. So I sort of wanted to build all that into the kind of choices of points of view.
And did you make a choice to delineate those two voices by chapters, because they are completely severed from one another, rather than have the voice or the point of view change mid-chapter or something?
Yeah, I did. I mean, to be honest, at the time I didn't ever really consider doing anything else with those two characters. Just that they had quite different experiences.
And Robin?
Well, my novel is about the creation of a book, and that book is central to the whole story. And I wanted to write about the people who were illuminating this book, decorating the book, as well as the woman who had ordered the book. And they were never going to see each other. But I wanted the book to be the communication between them, because the woman would read the book or look at the pictures and take what she would from it, but the people who were painting the book would have their own ideas about what they were painting and what she should learn from the book. So I knew that I wanted to understand this woman's point of view, as well as at least one of the people who were decorating the book. so I already had two main characters there, and I wanted their points of view. One of the people decorating the book is a woman, and I wanted to explore her experiences. And the other, the man who's also decorating the book, really, as would be his way as a character, kind of pushed his way in. When I was fussing around trying to get words on the page, he popped up and with quite a bit of energy. And so I went with that, and so I had three main characters, three third-person close points of view. And I had a moment's hesitation. Should I be, you know, going across three different people in one story? But in the end, I stuck with it, because I needed at least two of them, and I just liked the characters I had. So they really brought enough energy to the novel for me.
And how did you delineate these voices, like physically delineate them within the text?
Substantially, they have their own chapters. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
The woman who's receiving the book, she gets it after it's finished, obviously, but her timeline and the timeline of the characters that are decorating the book, they actually interact. That's too complicated to explain. It is quite complicated. One timeline goes back in time.
Yeah.
And they meet.
But one thing I think you did quite skillfully was that Matilda's are often, her chapters are often also delineated by being in the present tense, even though she then kind of often goes back into the past. And I thought, even though, you know, the chapters did have Matilda, the present tense really did start those chapters off with just a completely different taste.
Yes, so. Because, you're right. She's... I've actually forgotten. I'm in another world now. she's in present tense because she's... has received the book. As she's reading through it, we see... in past tense, the two painters that are painting the book. Mm-hmm. Quite complex to write, and lots of making sure that the timelines fitted. Yeah. But it gave me a good chance for all the characters to interact with one another via the pictures in the book.
And Julian?
So Opal Dragonfly is about the rise, spectacular rise and ignominious fall of a wealthy and very noted colonial family in 1850s Sydney, based probably more tightly than I'd like to admit on Sir Thomas Mitchell, the surveyor general and explorer, who seemed like a really interesting key figure as a map maker about, you know, the nature of settlement. Although he had really interesting views about Indigenous people, which were, you know, he's a controversial but interesting figure for that regard. So he was very attractive to me. And all the people who, it started really with place, Woolloomooloo Hill, the villas, the wealthy villas built on what's now Potts Point and King's Cross, which was a sort of social experiment by Governor Darling where he handed out big land grants and said, go for it, I want you to make Sydney beautiful and respectable. But it's very much told from the point of view of the youngest daughter, Isabel. In fact, opens with a scene, I think, that sets the tone of the book, which is her dad is going to fight a duel at dawn, and she knows he'll be killed because he's old, he's 60, as was Sir Thomas Mitchell, who picked fights with everybody in the colony. So she disguises herself as a boy and goes down there with the intention to disrupt this duel. So this begins her journey of discovery about her father and about her family. And the symbolic object, if you like, at the heart of this is this opal dragonfly, which is a family heirloom that appears in the sort of rather classic Gothic tradition of being a cursed object. Mm. What I like to investigate it is the family's legacy. How do you interpret it and how do you rewrite it from generation to generation? Mm. So she inherits from her father this sort of unfortunate... So that immediately suggested close third to me. I suppose I could have experimented with first, but I wanted to see her in a larger context. I wanted to be able to step back and see her in her times. The challenge, of course, is all three novels I've written from a point of view of women. Women don't often get a lot of access to information about big social patterns or political events. So, you know, I very much want to set my novels in those sort of contexts. I want people to understand some of the larger historical forces at work. But I don't want to info dump either.
Yeah.
Don't want to do that. But, you know, I had to find ways for the 17-year-old upper middle class girl to start to learn some more bitter truths about the nature of
life.
The
yeah.
Yeah. So that was challenging.
Okay, so given... you know, changing a point of view within a text, I think, is quite risky. You know, it is slightly discombobulating for a reader, which can be piquant if it's kind of well handled. So in each of you, when you've done this, what is the kind of textual basis for doing it? What did you gain that you could not have gained in another way, perhaps more simple way? I mean, do you want to go the other way around this time, or you have to...
Sure.
I get to start. Yeah. Time to think. Well, look, there is the thing I mentioned about getting like bigger picture, and how do you move into that? And, you know, editors get cross with you when you change voice too rapidly or abruptly. They're very anxious to keep you in one point of view. And by and large, I agree with that. If it's going to throw a reader, I think that's wrong. But I do think the use of point of view is very subtle and can be mixed up a bit, as long as the transitions are done well. So, for example, I wanted to give a sense of how devastating the 1840s depression was in Sydney. So it starts with literally the dad reading the newspaper every day and looking for the dreadful sign. So we start in a very intimate domestic thing to which she's got access. Mm. Then we move into really describing what's gone on, but we use some of the language that he's used. So we keep metaphors from the private conversation and use them to tell the bigger picture. Then we move back through something that happened to him. He gets mugged by some convicts, and he also witnesses what almost turns into a riot on the street, and comes home and tells his family, so we still tie it back to an intimate. And then finally, she watches all the other families on Woolloomooloo Hill who've gone bankrupt moving out. Mm. So I hope what I've done is move through different points of view, but in a way that hasn't thrown the reader, but give them, you know, enough context to understand the nature of it's not just a private drama, it's a social drama.
Yeah. And Robin?
What did I do? The woman who's... Well, that I talked about this a little bit because the woman who receives the book has her own distinctive timeline, and I have two illuminators in a very small shop working together, and they don't particularly get on. The woman doesn't trust the man, and the man basically thinks women shouldn't be painting. Excuse me. So what I wanted in that shop was the sense of the tension and the tightness of this little atelier where they're supposed to be working together to produce this magnificent book, and they don't get on. So there's quite a bit of sitting at their desks watching each other come in, go out. He's watching the woman paint and thinking, why on earth is she doing that? Why is she using gold leaf? She's not supposed to be using gold leaf. And mostly, and I have to admit that I didn't think about this beyond what the scene needed. Mostly, it's one character has a chapter where, you know, so the woman Gemma reflects on the other bloke in the shop and talks about her life. But every now and then I realise that I switch point of view within one chapter because I wanted the sense of the tension coming from both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think it works because I, as I said earlier, I see what they're seeing, and I see through their eyes very much. So when I shift from one character to another, I'm not seeing that from the outside. I'm seeing each character as they are viewing the other, and I think that that stops me falling into the kind of description that becomes confusing. I think it carries, the point of view carries through effectively. Mm. It's up to the reader to decide, I suppose.
And I do think that point of view can shift within a scene like that, and in other examples. I was just reading the new Philip Pullman, and I heard him say the other day something about what's wrong with third person omniscient. And he does use it, but in a quite close way, and he will shift to somebody else's point of view. And I think it's that sort of logic. It's this scene is quite a kind of intense, closed atmosphere, and I'm describing what it's like to be there, even if it's from somebody else's point of view for a moment. I mean, I don't tend to do that for whatever reason, but I don't mind it when I see it. I think it's quite interesting. One of the big point of view decisions for me that I felt like when I'd got that, I'd kind of cracked it, to partly to my own satisfaction, was there's a long middle section in the book that describes a period in my grandparents, Hannah and Emil's lives, where my grandfather, Emil, has escaped from Germany just as the Nazis come to power. He's a trade unionist, he's an anti-Nazi activist, and he has to leave. And he meets Hannah in Brussels, where she's working for the trade unions, and they get to England. And they're running a youth hostel in Winchester. And quite, as far as I know, quite a lot happened while they were there. I've seen pictures of his former wife and son visit them there, and I thought, how did that work? You know, so those are the kind of things that I really wanted to explore. And also, another thing that I heard was that they used to have these German youth groups come to hike through the English countryside. And at dinner, they sang a song talking about spilling the blood of the Jews. My grandmother was Jewish, and, you know, my grandfather had escaped the Nazis. And these kind of incredibly sort of resonant moments. And then the other one was that on one of their hiking trips, Emil discovers that they're marking strategic points on maps as spies, basically. So to send the information back to Germany about where it would be effective to plant bombs or whatever, on bridges and so on. So for some reason, I had this from Hannah's point of view, when it was kind of all the German stuff coming to England. And I think I was reluctant because I would, I knew that I needed to rewrite quite a large chunk of the novel if I changed that decision. And then I just thought, oh, come on, you have to do it. And I did it. And I thought, oh, you know, I wish I hadn't resisted for so long. But it needed to be filtered through, you know, the two women, the kids coming, who he can understand the things they're saying and doing, that it had to be through his point of view.
Given we're at a historical novel conference, I thought I'd just ask the three of you quickly if you think that there are any unique considerations with point of view that come to writing historical fiction. You know, I was just thinking about trying to get a subjective voice in a character when you have just completely objective information. So does that dissuade you from, I mean, you have talked of that, dissuade you from a first-person narrative into a third-person narrative and things like that. I just wonder if you've experienced things with that.
I think there was, with this particular story, and I can imagine others where it would be the same, there was that idea of decorum about not assuming certain kinds of knowledge. And I think that's a very kind of live issue at the moment about whose voice we speak in. But on the other hand, I think, you know, particularly the further back you go, one of the attractions of historical fiction is that kind of gap that's there, where, you know, really the novelistic question to me is, well, what did that feel like, you know? And so that's kind of the fuel of it, I think. I don't know.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that we are writing characters in a particular situation, and how they feel, what they think, they're the things that are really central. I think that whether it's historical or contemporary, we really do need to inhabit those characters. For me, that means I couldn't write omniscient, I don't think. And I think that would actually be harder because you would be assuming that you knew the whole of that world. And it's much. And when I started writing Book of Colours, my last novel set in London, I was really anxious about how to portray London and how would I know what 14th century London was like. And then I thought about it, worried about it for quite a while, as I do, and then eventually I realised that my characters were the people who were seeing London. I wasn't writing all of London. I was writing a character's experience of London, and my characters were artists. So they would see London in a way that maybe the prostitutes wouldn't, or something like that. So it is actually easier than if I set out to... If I was taking an omniscient point of view, I'd be more likely to worry whether I had all the facts or, you know, had some truth about London there, whereas now I'm just creating William's perspective on London and Gemma's perspective on London. And that takes away some of the daunting responsibility of authenticity, I think.
Certainly in terms of voices, you know, I didn't know much about 1850 Sydney. You could put it in a symbol how much I knew about 1850 Sydney. Gold rushes or something, that's about all I knew. Didn't know about gold rush widows and the scale of the evacuation of Sydney and this sort of thing. So I found it very helpful to, you know, while it's important to empathise and to try and feel, obviously, what historic characters, they always bring that challenge of different worldview that's so very different to your own. And so I found it enormously helpful to find the diaries, in fact, of Blanche Mitchell, Sir Thomas Mitchell's youngest daughter. What a gift. Mm. And there were all sorts of presumptions I'd made about the Victorian period. This is how people are in Victoria. Mm. Not true. I mean, extraordinarily racy and kind of, you know. There's a scene where she gets pissed on champagne on the beach in Watson's Bay and loses one of her undergarments. And a chivalrous officer runs up the beach and gives it to her. And I couldn't have made that up. I wouldn't have dared make that up. So that was a gift.
Yeah.
But in terms of voice too and beliefs, letters, I read Fanny Maclay's letters to her brother and rediscovered that whole phenomena of women who probably were unlikely to get married, who were going to be the one who stays at home, having this incredible crush on an older sibling. Mm. Which is not something you automatically think of today, but it was definitely there. So I found that very, very useful to help me not ventriloquise, as I like to put it, you know, not to put a modern sensibility in.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's a tightrope you walk.
Yeah.
If they're so alien from you, and I admire people who go further back into history, into areas I would hardly dare.
Yeah.
So I've always written, you know, 19th, 20th century. We're kind of just coming into the modern age, so there's enough to empathise with. But, very useful to have a rich archive to help you overcome things. I found out all about women's fancy work. This was a thing that women would embroider thousands of things to sell for charity.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing there was this whole idea of the deserving poor. Which is smack bang in the middle of gender today, I feel.
Yeah. Just quickly, in the few moments we've got left, I just wanted to ask each of you a specific kind of strategy with your novels. First with Belinda, like Flora's opening narrative, which you've discussed, does give a lot away. You know, we know that Hannah and Emil get together, that they've reproduced, they had progeny, survives. Lots of things. What was your kind of strategy with that opening?
Well, I think it was connected to the other decisions that I made about point of view, which was that I wanted the idea of inheritance to be at the centre of the novel. So it was less about... I mean, I think there is suspense in it in various ways, but... So it was less about... you know, whether Hannah survives or not and so on... you know, and has children, and more about kind of what remains, you know, what is it to receive a family story? What do you do with it? So that opening where she receives the papers and so on is really to put that at the centre of it before you start reading.
Yeah.
their actual lives.
So it's really setting the story's themes up.
Yeah.
So you've achieved that through point of view.
Yeah.
You've fortified your theme through point of view. And Robin, with Robin's Book of Colours, there's a book within the book, or more than one book within the book, really. But there's one specific book, The Art of Illumination, which goes through the book at the beginning of some of the chapters that are in London. But it's a very different type of text. I'm just wondering what your point of view strategy was with that.
This is one of the illuminators is writing kind of guide to illumination and excerpts from as this character is writing the book throughout the novel, excerpts from it at the beginning of each chapter and related subtly to what's happening in that chapter. And I really wrote that, again, on instinct. I really just wanted it to be a book of, like, recipes and instruction, but also a little bit of philosophy that this illumination isn't simply, you know, you have to do this and then do that, but it's about the character, whoever is, the instructions for the apprentice illuminator are really philosophical as well as practical. And I wrote that very much as this person speaking to another one. And I wanted an amount of intimacy, I think, as well as that sense of instruction, and a sense of authority as well. I wanted that tone in it. What it gave me was another kind of layer to the novel. It wasn't just about, well, isn't this interesting? This is how they made vermilion in the 14th century. Although that in itself is fascinating, but I wanted it to be another layer of authority, establishing this character's authority, as well as a certain amount of that character's personality as it came through in the writing. And the really interesting thing is that I took little bits of the style of it from 14th century manuals that were given on illumination that were given to artists, but I pretty much wrote it myself. And I really enjoyed doing it. It was one of, if I was stuck with the story, I think I'll write another one of these little excerpts, and it's quite good fun. But I've had a lot of people write and ask me what the name of the book is so they can go online. I actually had somebody suggest that we should get the publishers to make a coffee table of it. I don't think they'll stretch to that, but it's a lovely thought. But it's fascinating to me that the thing that I found almost easiest about the whole novel people think is not something that I wrote, but a genuine article, which is very nice.
And Julian, just quickly, because it might be nice to try and get some questions. At the end of the Opal Dragonfly, you jump forward in time and into a first-person narrator. It does take a while for... And the narrator is talking to a you, and it does take a while for the you to... And I think you kind of... skewed it a little bit more with the repetition of the name Winnie. So it kind of does take a while for all of that to settle down. Mm. I'm just kind of wondering what your strategy was to have such a, for want of a better word, rupture in the text.
Mm. Mm. Well, readers have reacted differently. Some have said it was a rupture and they wanted all the in-between chapters, the 40 years. Mm. No, it's a whole other book. Others said, oh, you know, this is great. I felt like the audience. So I probably, now I think about it, maybe obfuscated quite who was being spoken to at first and wanted you as the reader to being addressed, Winnie being...
It felt like that.
Good. Yeah. And we're back to story again. Mm. We're putting the whole thing in perspective now. We're looking, it was about an intergenerational problem, a legacy. So I've decided to deal with that legacy as, you know, the story goes on kind of effect. Mm. I also wanted to show off a different voice. I wanted to show I could write, you know, mid-Victorian decorous Jane Austen style. And now we're going to shift into a different voice altogether. But just to sort of give the sense of the history, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming, and I'll just remind you that our authors will be in the bookshop so you can indulge further in their points of view.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website, www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.